I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos.
Yeah, right. Crazy.
Hello and welcome to episode number 111 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. If you're in the UK, happy lockdown restriction day. Firstly, as ever, thank you to the Patreon supporters, new and old, without whom I wouldn't be able to make this podcast. And if you'd like to support us from as little as £3 a month, you can do so in the Instagram bio or go into www.patreon.com/Ministry of Arts. And if you're not able to, that's fine. The content is free here for everyone anyway. This episode was meant to be an artist who is better known for their work in television. But I've had a little shift around because this week's guest talks about an exhibition they're involved with that ends at the end of the month. So I thought it'd be beneficial just to swap them around. Now this week's episode is internationally respected art historian and curator Michael Pepiat. Along with thousands of other people, one of my favourite artists is Francis Bacon. And I've read several books on his life and work, most of which were written by Michael. Because as well as being Francis Bacon's close friend for many years, he was also his biographer. And I'll be honest, when it comes to speaking to Michael, I was a little bit intimidated. I mean, the man's been in the art world longer than I've been in the actual world. He started at the Observer newspaper in 1964 as junior art critic. And today he's an internationally respected expert in 20th century art. He's put major exhibitions on all around the world. And his exhibition, Francis Bacon, Man and Beast, was meant to be at the Royal Academy this January, but has been postponed because of lockdown restrictions and has now been moved to January 2022. He has got a current exhibition at Ben Brown Fine Art in London that has been running for quite some time, but was interrupted by lockdown. And that was an exhibition called What is Ahead, as in What is Ahead, which features the work of Frank Auerbach and Tony Bevan. And Tony Bevan holds a special little place in my heart because he was another artist that wrote to me while I was in prison. And that show runs until the 30th of April before it's taken down and moves over to the Ben Brown Gallery in Hong Kong. Michael lives in southwest France, and as much as I'd have loved to have popped over and recorded this episode in person, we had to do it over Zoom, unfortunately. But there you go. Better luck next time. So please, come and join me, art historian and curator, Michael Pepiat.
That's the way of the world.
How
did you find it limiting?
I've just had to adjust my practice a little bit, you know.
Can you work at home? Is that all right?
I mean, yeah, it's all right by me. I've been doing drawings the last year, so.
Oh, right.
So, yeah, that's just fine. Yeah,
I've been doing that. Quite writing, isn't it? You can do it anywhere.
There's a show on the Ben Brown Fine Arts with Frank Auerbach and Tony Bevan. What is Ahead? Yes. I've seen the show. I've only seen it online, but there's a video tour around the show. What a great couple of artists to curate their show.
Aren't we lucky? Yes, indeed. So this came about really, like many things that that work, came about by chance in a sense. I did an exhibition a long time ago, about 20 years ago, in Paris at the Musée Maillot, and it was called From Bacon to Bevan. And Auerbach was, of course, in it as being a sort of School of London artist.
Yeah.
I noticed that there was a distinct rapport between his work and Tony Bevan's work. Yeah. And I discussed with Ben Brown the idea of redoing that show 20 years later, but that was very, very complicated. And he was able to borrow a fair number of works, I think 10 works by Auerbach, and he has his sort of pick of Tony Bevan's work because he represents it.
Yeah, brilliant.
He has a lot, and Tony has others in his studio. So we were able to bring the two artists together. We made the choice. Tony helped a lot on the hang because I'm here in Southwest France and can't get back. And so we discussed the whole concept, Tony and I. Frank, as you probably know, has just turned 90 and he's painting away like mad and making every second count. So he doesn't really get involved in,
pretty much anything outside the studio. Yeah,
you know, he's got that well-worn path to his studio, and once he's in there, you know, he's with his painting, and he does what he's been doing for the last god knows certainly 70 years. Anyway, but he gave his blessing to the show, and that was nice to know. And it's been a very sort of interesting experience because I feel that it's one of those shows. I mean, I would say this, I suppose, you know, they don't always work, these sort of dual or triple shows. You know, you come up with, Leonardo and Leonora Carrington or something.
Perhaps
sometimes they work, and sometimes you suddenly think, I don't think this is going anywhere. But this...
They sit beautifully next to each other, don't they?
Yes, they do. Well, they talk. There's a dialogue.
Definitely.
I feel. And what I think is nice about this, I mean, there are all sorts of finer points, I suppose, one can find between the art of one and the art of other, but what is, what is there immediately is a sort of dialogue where you're very conscious of what paint can do with a different artist.
Definitely.
And since the subject is similar in all these pictures, it's like, that's how he approaches it, whereas Bevan is more linear, more conceptual, let's say. It's less sort of coming from within the fibre of the paint. And so it's a different approach, but not so different as there aren't lots of points of comparison and lots of differences. And I think that dialogue tells you a lot about the simple act of painting, not the simple act of painting, but the actual act of painting and how different it can be.
And today, I mean, the Head and Shoulders is probably more prevalent than it's ever been in society, especially this last year. Like even you and I at the moment talking over Zoom, we can only see each other's head and shoulders. FaceTime has been needed for so many people, and
Well, perhaps we, you know, little by little will be nothing but head and shoulders. if this goes on, perhaps the whole lower body, I hope not, but the whole lower body might atrophy, you know, will become like sort of lizards or something, with a prominent head and disappearing tail of a body. But obviously the subject is interesting too, because as I sort of entitled that short text that I wrote for the exhibition, What is a Head? What is it? It's everything, really. Yeah. It's the whole human psyche, the whole whole of human existence. I mean, it's a curious concept, a head rather than a face.
Yeah.
There's a big difference, you know. I mean, a head is a sort of like a this precious container. A face is more the facade.
Yeah, yeah, just the identity, isn't it?
Yes, it's the sort of identity. Well, it's the sort of, you know, it's the first layer of the identity, because as we all know, you know, the face can be a sort of disguise, can be a kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, camouflage.
Yeah, yeah.
And the head is all the working. It's all the almost the electronics, the machine,
the control center. Yeah.
Yes, exactly that. It's a control center of everything, of everything we know, everything we see, everything we think. Obviously.
Yeah.
Whereas the face is not necessarily that. It's what shows. And the head is a more interesting concept, and I think in these two cases the painters come at it from a very different point. I've always been fascinated by the fact that Auerbach arrived in England as a refugee from Nazi Germany as a very small boy, and he seems to have by his own account he seems to have fitted in quite quickly. You know, he learned how to play cricket sort of early on, and wanted, no doubt, as one does, particularly when one's little, to fit in as soon as possible and not sort of stick out and be more vulnerable than necessary. And I've always wondered how he coped with that loss, because he never saw his parents again. Yeah. Or a lot, probably many of the people that of his friends' families disappeared, and that must have left a deep trauma behind. And
how old was he, Michael, when he came over? Do you know?
About 8.
Yeah. That's old enough to keep hold of a vision and a memory of the parents, isn't it?
Yes.
He's younger, and he may well have forgotten.
Earlier, I mean, I didn't check my facts. I should have done, but I suspect if he came over in, well, I won't try and work it out, but he was he was a boy around that
age. Yeah.
And all his painting, in a way, has been sort of like an excavation. I mean, he excavates, it seems to me, he excavates images through these layers, these mounds of very thick pigment.
Yeah.
And what fascinates me about his faces, his heads, his figures, is that they seem to rise through the accretions of paint, as though they're, you know, they've been produced by the paint, like almost a body resurfacing through the earth. Whereas Bevan is more conceptual, more linear. He has I know there are plenty of accidents, because we've talked a lot, Bevan and I, a lot of accidents as he's actually creating his paintings, but they seem to be more, less left to chance.
Definitely.
Sort of imposed on the canvas with a plan, with a concept already formed.
It's only his rapid process of putting the marks on the canvas that have made these sort of happy accidents happen in the first place.
And with the charcoal breaking and the spray of charcoal, and he incorporates those accidents as part of the genesis, as it were, of the picture, which does give it an extra sort of dimension.
Yeah, and he's got a very exciting manner in which he paints, hasn't he?
And they're sort of I mean, he approaches the head, I think, more as a almost an architectural space. You get to walk around, yeah. You know, to travel within these heads and see what extraordinary constructions they are.
A lot of the time, there's quite little form within the head that he paints, but he's still got a very tactile feel.
Very fragile too, although they tend to be very big and dominant against the picture plane. I'm always fascinated by the neck. The neck seems to be the most vulnerable part. You know, yeah. It's full of sort of accident. I mean, almost like a piece of wood with knots in it and veins standing out.
Because it's quite linear. It makes it, I'm doing the action here that no one's going to see anyway, but because his strokes are quite linear, it almost looks like there's a strain on the neck, doesn't it? Pulling the sinews and muscles being tensed.
Yes, as though all the tendons or whatever they are standing up, like somebody under considerable strain. And perhaps that's, I mean, I think they are pictures of anxiety. He uses his own features, as it were. That way he can do whatever he likes because he doesn't have to. He's not painting a portrait. None of these really come across as portraits, but much more as heads.
Unfortunately, the exhibition has pretty much been closed because of lockdown.
I know.
And it's, when does it end?
I think it ends in April, and then it's going to the Ben Brown Gallery in Hong Kong.
Excellent.
So it's a little bit further to go.
Well, hopefully the guys in Hong Kong will have a better timing than we have in the UK to be able to see it. Just as we're talking there, I just had a little check, and it's the 30th of April that it closes in the UK.
Yes.
But as I say, it's very unlikely anyone will be able to physically go to see it. But on Ben Brown Fine Arts website... I'm
always behind.
There's possibly a bit of movement from, I think it's the 12th of April over here. But things aren't properly opening until mid-May. Or they're much more relaxed in mid-May.
Obviously, when you're in the room and you've got the, you know, you can see the brushwork, you can see the difference in almost tactility, as Definitely. It were, from one painting to another. It's a different language. It's a bit like, yes, I've thought about it at certain moments as two languages that, you know, that are similar, say Spanish and Portuguese or Spanish and Italian.
Yeah.
Where, you know, one, you pick up sounds in the various languages and you see, yes, there are these similarities and these differences, you know.
Yeah.
That, so it makes your eye more sort of acute, more nimble, and you start seeing things as you look from one artist to another. It sort of sharpens your visual sense.
Well, it's definitely like, as you were just saying there, they're speaking the same language, but with a slightly different accent, aren't they, you know?
That's a very good way of putting it. Brilliant. Yes, it's sort of different dialects.
Exactly. You mentioned, obviously, Francis Bacon, you know, is good friends visually with both of these artists. You're curating an exhibition, Man and Beast, which should have opened a couple of months ago at the RA, but has now been postponed until this time, or until January next year.
I know. Now it seems sort of almost normal. I mean, what strange...
You was nearly there.
Oh, no, we're opening in a year. Please come back then.
But, I mean, there's no one better placed on the planet probably than yourself to talk about Francis Bacon, which is very exciting for me.
I might quote you on that, you know.
you can have it.
Come in very useful.
Not that anyone's going to pay any attention to what I've got to say anyway, Mike.
Oh, I'm not sure.
But yeah, Man and Beast. I know a little bit about the show. Well, if I can, even before I ask you a question, there was a beautiful quote that I read about it, and it says that that the exhibition explores Francis Bacon's visceral paintings, where the line between human and animal is constantly blurred, reminding us that our primal instincts lie just below the surface. I don't know if that was your quote or not, but either way, that is...
Well, that sums up the show fairly well. Bacon was always conscious of the animal in man. And of course, we are animals. I mean, there's just no, we're not a sort of complete separate, you know, being. We're part of the animal kingdom. And probably, you know, more terrifying than any of the animals. Some of them, you know, look quite, in Bacon's painting, some of the animals, and he painted, I mean, having had this concept and having agreed with the RA that we could do an exhibition on that theme, I realized that animals are really unexpectedly present, just actual paintings of animals, images of animals. So it's quite clear that he had, he was fascinated, and of course, I knew he was fascinated by animals. And I think really his fascination stemmed from the fact that looking at animals, you know, they're less inhibited. They don't cover up. They are what they are. Mm. Whereas human beings spend half their time sort of trying to look.
Yeah, building a facade.
They think it might sort of help them, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know, seduce somebody or whatever. Whereas animals just go for it. And I think he found them more reliable than human beings because they, you know, they are what they are.
Yeah, there was no pretense.
Disguise it.
Yeah.
And so he was fascinated by animal behavior because, as I must say, I am, because you see, you know, I've watched baboon fooling around, playing, having ceremonies. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating because you can just sort of put them in suits.
Yeah.
And you're very close to a sort of, you know, a business meeting or something.
Yeah, I've probably seen people behaving a lot worse in my time.
Yes, I'm sure. So it was a way, I think, for him of evaluating people. And he referred back to a lot of photos of animals at different times because obviously they're almost like a mirror of human behavior, but more direct. And so at the same time, he looked for the animal in man as being the basic instinct, what makes us tick.
Mm.
And that's what interested him most, was to know what made people tick, you know, what their real drives, impulses were. And his painting is mainly about that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
How many paintings will be on show?
Well, we're still in the process of confirming, you know, that the loans will still be available. I would think it could be, it's not a large show. And of course, you know, with all the, everything that's happened and from a budgetary point of view, it's going to be, I would say 45 paintings, something like that.
That's more than I was expecting.
Yes, I mean, it'll be a handsome show, and it will be very much on that theme. Yeah. You know, the as it were, the almost interchangeability in Bacon's world between animal and man, between beast and man. And the fact that Bacon goes, you know, right to the jugular, as it were, the animal jugular of man, and shows man, even popes, as animals.
Well, you're saying that the primal instinct is just below the surface. I mean, that's definitely what Bacon was trying to do. He was trying to pull away the surface of all of these subjects.
Yes,
to show
the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, after all, he was thought of certainly during the from the earlier part of his career as a sort of morbid fantasist.
Yeah.
But having lived through the war, having lived, well, in a sense, through two world wars, what could be more horrific than actually what actually went on in the war? Not his paintings are sort of quite dainty in comparison
to
horrors of war. So I just remember, people sort of, while he was still, he wasn't an old man, but I once was meeting him in a museum, and there was a lady coming past. I think she must have been Catholic because she had a sort of golden cross around her neck. And when she saw a Bacon in there in this collection, she put her hand over her eyes. So when Francis turned up, I said, I told him, and he said, "Oh, good."
Yeah, I could imagine that being right up his street. I got into art very late in life. I didn't get into art till I was like 28 years of age. I had no interest in it before that. No, and then I just stumbled into the art world.
Very interesting story.
And fell in love with it. And Francis Bacon was, I think it was because of his attitude. I think he was probably the third or fourth artist I'd ever looked at.
Oh, right.
And when I saw his attitude and, his the way he sort of carried himself.
Yes.
And I just sort of fell in love with him there again. And I was getting books sent in, and, obviously they were, many of them were, had your name on everything that I read pretty much. When I was, do you know my background?
Not really, just a bit.
Right, I was in prison when I discovered art.
Yes.
And doing a prison sentence. And when I was in there, I discovered the golden mean as well. And I got obsessed with the golden mean for a little while, just when I was becoming obsessed with Bacon's work.
Oh, right.
And I started laying the golden mean over Bacon's work, knowing how spontaneous he was.
Yeah.
And that he couldn't have laid this structure over the top of it. But when I laid the golden mean over the top of his artworks, so many of the points in his work were pinging up on that rigid mathematical structure, which I thought was quite amazing.
The golden mean is one third and two thirds?
Yeah, all round about that.
Yes.
I was laying that rigid structure over the top of his artwork, bearing in mind that some of the paintings I was looking at only through like books and catalogues were probably crots a little bit, But either way, from what I had in front of me, I put the golden mean over the top, and so many elements, it might be a light switch, would come up in that area, or like where he was wearing a watch, for instance, that the watch would be the crossing point of the golden mean. It was really quite extraordinary.
Yes, yes. Well, I think he, he was, he had all sorts of reserves. I mean, in the sense of reserves of knowledge and pockets of cunning and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a very complex character. He liked to present himself as a kind of almost a wild man, who'd sort of grown up on some, lost farm in the wilds of Ireland. Yeah. He was also very sophisticated.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a bit of both. And I think, although he thought, his own account was that he had just taken whatever he found as a young man, and it all came together through. But I think he studied very hard.
Yeah, and funnily enough, at the time, because I was writing to a lot of artists and people within the arts.
Oh yes.
I just at that point I was corresponding with Brian Sewell.
Oh yeah.
As I said, I'd done a dissertation at uni, but I discovered this several years earlier when I was in prison. So I sent this photocopy of like these findings out to Brian just to see what he thought of it. And yeah. I remember the letter he sent back, the very first line was, this is brilliant yet unfounded. And he was saying that Francis Bacon would never have used that method. Not that I was trying to say that he was by any means.
Well, he certainly used the T-square and things like that. He also used to do some of those circles. He used a dustbin.
I've seen that. Brilliant.
Yes.
Brilliant.
And, you know, he'd take a frying pan to mix his paints. I mean, when he was Excellent. Up and going, he just took whatever was to hand. And I'm sure he would have been, I mean, he said, you know, with time I've become technically more wily.
Yeah.
That he experimented because he was very interested in technique. Mm. You know, he said, you know, what you really want is to get to a stage where technique and subject really interlocked.
Yeah.
And I think he went on experimenting with technique the whole time because it was, you know, it gave him new possibilities. So I think that a lot of things are quite possible like that, you know.
Yeah.
He did check with, or perhaps he had an instinctive golden mean. I mean, it is probably...
I'm sure that if he was aware of it, and, you know, once you're aware of those rules, they come in subconsciously anyway when you're setting out the composition of a painting anyway, don't they, you know? Yeah. I understand also another little story was that when you was going over to France, Francis also gave you a letter of introduction to Giacometti.
Yes, he did. He did. I wish I still had it, but it was a long time ago. It must have been something like 65, 66.
Wow.
And I was going for my first real job. I got a job. My father had been after me for not sort of, you know, I was basically sort of just drifting around trying to have a good time. I wasn't very keen on sort of getting, you know, being employed. But he sent me an ad really asking for a junior editor on a magazine in Paris. And I didn't really want to go to Paris. I was very, very happy in London. I had friends there and, you know, things were looking up. I'd managed to get a nice girlfriend and so on. So I was really quite pleased. But, you know, this was a job and I thought, well, I better take it. Not knowing I'd stay for nearly 35 years, come back to France. But Francis said, who do you know in Paris? Of course, I didn't know anybody.
Yeah.
And he said, well, why don't you go and see Giacometti? And I thought, well, you know, that's mad. I can't just go and barge in on somebody I've never met and say, well, here I am.
Yeah. You know?
So he said, no, I'll write you a letter. So he scrawled this letter, ripped out a couple of pages Brilliant. From Paris Match and scrawled this letter to Giacometti in green ink, I remember, over war photographs. So I took it to Paris with me, and then I realized quite quickly that I got a little sort of studio, little apartment in the same area as Giacometti's studio, where he worked and lived. And so I just, you know, I went down and I saw where the studio was, and I knew I got the right place because he had Giacometti written in white capital letters on the glass in the door.
Yeah.
And then I got overcome by shyness, you know, and I thought, well, you know, how can I just go and knock on his door and disturb him?
I'm with you there.
Some really important work, and here's this, you know, youth that's just turned up and I'm interrupting. So I had a problem with that, and I kept walking round and round with holding this letter, thinking, you know, how can I deliver it?
Yeah, plucking up the courage.
Yes. And, you know, I probably have a few drinks and go and rap on his door. But then I was told he just that week died because he'd gone back to Switzerland, gone into a hospital. He'd been, you know, he hadn't been well for some time.
Yeah.
And I realized that Bacon might have known that he was not in good health because he'd seen quite a lot of him the previous year when he had an exhibition at the Tate in 65. But anyway, there it was. He was dead, and you know, there was no way I was going to meet him. But I got very fascinated by what hadn't happened, as it were. I thought, you know, I met him. We might have become friends, as I'd become friends with Bacon, and my life might have taken a completely different turn. You know, I met people through him, and perhaps we would have talked a lot, and I'd have done a book about him. And so anyway, I started collecting catalogues and photographs and all sorts of things about Giacometti in the studio. And I began to meet all the people around it because I had this interest. And once you met one, it sort of, you know, the critics who've written about him, met his widow, Annette, his brother, it was two brothers, Bruno and Diego. Diego was the one who worked with him. In his studio and made the, you know, did the patina on the sculpture and made the bases for the sculptures and was his sort of kind of technician and advisor and all sorts of things. We were very, very close. Also his model, because he sat. I mean, basically he used Annette, his wife, and Diego, his brother, because they were always on hand.
And free.
Anyway, so this has gone on for a long time. I've done several Giacometti exhibitions, and I've done several small books and catalog texts on Giacometti. But I now have the possibility, rather, sort of a long time, nearly 60 years after that, to write a whole book about it. So
excellent.
I'm sort of in the middle of that, and it's fascinating and very difficult because so many good writers have written about Giacometti, and I want to say something new, otherwise it's not worth writing a book, and also bring in what interests me in particular in this book is to bring in his world, because his world was extraordinary. You know, he came from this mountain village in Switzerland, and when he arrived in Paris, he was right at the center of surrealism. You know, he got there, he came, you know, barely sort of, you know, stamped the mountain mud off his boots. And there he was, because he was enormously gifted and talented and attractive as a person. He found himself in the middle of this extraordinary, you know, crazy movement that threw everything really out of the window and wanted to start over again. As a result, really, of the horrors of the First World War, they thought, you know, throw it all out, start again, use your imagination, let yourself be guided by dreams and so on. And he was caught up in all that. And if you sort of study Giacometti, you inevitably come across all these extraordinary people that he knew and were part of his life.
Yeah,
with the surrealists, and then after the war with the existentialists, with people like Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir and Camus and the philosophers of the time. And his relationship with writers fascinates me hugely, because he had all the surrealist poets kind of as close friends. And then after the war, people like Sartre and then Jean Genet and Beckett, who was became a close friend. You know, in a sense, they're quite close in their vision of things.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Beckett figures these gaunt sort of people without hope.
There was plenty of those at that time, wasn't there?
Yes. I mean, post-war Paris was an extraordinary phenomenon because, after all, it had been occupied all those years and had suffered, you know, had suffered sort of the humiliation and the lack of freedom that having, you know, as it were, an enemy occupy your city. And then there was a sort of explosion afterwards, and Giacometti was part of that. I mean, that's where his work really took off, and he became from having been during the war, completely sort of, he kept working at his sculptures until they disappeared completely. He tried to get this vision he'd had he had of the love of his life at that point. He saw her from far off, standing, waiting for him at the end of the Boulevard Saint-Michel. And I'll try and make this a very short story. He felt all this emotion for her, and seeing her vulnerable like that against the dark building and the night sky, mm-hmm. looking so tiny, he wanted to capture that in a sculpture.
Yeah.
And the only thing he could think of, because he was a very, very intelligent man, and this occupied him for all the war years when he was in Geneva. He went back to Switzerland to look after, to be with his mother and so on, was the sculptures got smaller and smaller and ended up in little heaps of dust.
Excellent.
So that when he came back from after the war, he had nothing to show for the five years he'd been working.
Yeah.
And then suddenly his figures came together again and started becoming elongated and you know, this craggy kind of survivor life.
It's almost that the shape of his sculptures is almost the shadow of the person that,
it's
that,
true.
That you're describing. Well, yeah,
like walking shadows, yeah. Or standing shadows. Anyway, so oddly, from having been totally obscure and living basically from handouts from his mum, you know, because he couldn't sell any, there's nothing to sell, yeah. You know. And from everybody thinking, oh, poor old Alberto, you know, he's gone mad, you know, he sort of can't get it together. He used to be so talented, and now he's got obsessed by this one figure that he can't realize. And he lived in this extraordinary hermit-like way, obsessed by this one thing. And then he became famous. It was a very odd thing, because he was actually perfectly happy to continue like that.
Yeah.
But I suppose, you know, he was pleased that his mum was pleased, because he was suddenly successful.
Yeah.
And didn't have to live off her any longer. And he had this extraordinary sort of range of friends, and Paris, for me, was a very fascinating thing, rising from its ashes, as it were.
Definitely.
And then all those marvellous people that, you know, that got together in the evening, often because they got together in cafes because their apartments were stone cold and they couldn't keep warm. So they went to a cafe and had a glass of wine or something like that and made it last. And so they had these wonderful conversations, and it was a rebirth.
And when do you think this book may be coming out?
Well, I hope next year, if I can manage to finish it this year. But it is a long, because he was such a complex and central and important figure. I write one thing, and then I realise there are three other things to say. But I don't want to do one of those great big telephone directories. I want to keep it compact.
Do what he done and just cut it away.
Yes, that's right. I want to cut it to the bone, a bit like the Japanese sculptors. You know, I mean,
but don't end up with just a pile of torn up paper at the end of it, though.
I hope not. I'll certainly try to avoid that. Yes, exactly. The whittled down. I want to keep it. But I want to keep it. I get very annoyed with those books. You know, you start reading them, say in bed when you're going to sleep, and they literally fall from your hands because they're so heavy. You know, it's sort of 900 pages. So I'm trying to keep it compact. But one is always with Giacometti. One is always conscious of the fact that there is so much to say. I mean, you introduce a word like Sartre, and of course you could write a book within a book.
Yeah.
And you have to keep it, so you have to have this discipline all the time. You get in so much and you think, well, Jean-Paul Sartre, that's all you're going to get.
Yeah, you're getting a name check.
Yes, that's right. You're in, you know, we can't go any further. Because otherwise it takes you right off your path, you know. Yeah. I mean, you've got to keep to the path, you know. What? Meanwhile, what is Alberto doing while we're talking about Sartre? You know, he's producing new sculpture. To mention that, and you know, so it's a fascinating task.
As well as the book, will there be anything physical going along with it?
There might be an exhibition. I've got several notions going on. I'm beginning to develop an idea. It would be nice to have an exhibition at the same time.
And would you be thinking of having it in France or the UK?
I'm not at all sure. It's sort of moving around at the moment, and it's too early days to say anything. It's not that I'm superstitious, but it really is. Yeah, you know, and... Yeah. But I think it would be wonderful to have an exhibition, perhaps more than one exhibition, going to more than one place,
yeah.
Something like that. Yes, brilliant. A traveling exhibition.
Let's hope that can take place. So,
yeah,
in summary, we've got what is ahead at Ben Brown Fine Arts in London, which is closing on the 30th. You can still see it online, and it's then if you happen to be passing Hong Kong, pop in and see it in Hong Kong later on in the year.
That's what it does.
Yeah, Francis Bacon's Man and Beast, which I am so looking forward to.
Oh, thank you.
In January next year. And the book, have you got a title for the Giacometti book yet?
It's probably Giacometti in Paris.
Perfect.
Simplest possible title. That sums it up in a nutshell.
Brilliant. Michael, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
And I could have spent an hour or so speaking about each of these subjects.
Well, perhaps we'll do that sometime.
I'd love to. Thank you, mate. All the very best.
All the best.
Thank you for your time. See you later. There you go, Michael Pepiat. I was properly excited to record this episode. I hope my nerves didn't show too much at the start, although they did go pretty quickly, I've got to say. As Michael mentioned there, What Is Ahead is on at Ben Brown's in London until the 30th of April. And if you're listening in Hong Kong, hang tight, it'll be there soon. So that's about it for this week. Thank you to KTW London for putting me and Michael together and making this episode possible. In between now and the next scheduled episode, there will be a bonus episode by Never Label about their exhibition at Art Snug, which is entitled Restore Mother Earth, part of World Earth Day, which is on April the 22nd. So keep your eyes open for that one. Like I say every week, on whichever platform you listen to this podcast, you should be able to leave a comment. If you could do that, that really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast. If you've got any queries, drop us a line on social media at ministryofarts.org. If you're enjoying these episodes, spread the word of the Ministry of Arts podcast. Thanks for listening, and until next week, ta-da.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.